Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear us all well? Great, wonderful. My name is George Krupp, and I am the moderator for today's session. To my right is Jonathan Horn, author and former White House presidential speechwriter, whose new book, Robert E. Lee Biography, The Man Who Would Not Be Washington, made Washington Post bestseller list. Jonathan has appeared on MSNBC, PBS, NewsHour, C-SPAN, and BBC Radio. His writings have appeared in The Washington Post, The New York Times, Disunion Series, The Weekly Standard, and other outlets. A graduate of Yale University, Jonathan now lives with his wife Caroline in Bethesda, Maryland. As a reminder, Jonathan will be signing copies of his book downstairs in Gordon after this session. So, Jonathan, welcome. Let's start by talking a little bit about the premise of your book.
Sure, and thank you so much for having me, George. I'm so honored to be at the Boston Book Festival. Let me just start by stating the obvious. At first glance, I don't look like someone who would write a biography of Robert E. Lee. I grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., the Maryland suburbs, and I still live there today. And around those parts, when you hear that someone is planning to write a Civil War biography, you expect it to be about a Union general, not a Confederate general. And you certainly don't expect it to be about that Confederate general, the old marble model himself, Robert E. Lee. For a long time, I avoided explaining myself. I did what you do expect someone from Washington to do when confronted with a tough question. I ducked it. Today, I want to just take a brief moment to explain myself. What first drew me to Robert E. Lee is probably what you would least expect, simple geography. Simply put, Robert E. Lee and I grew up along the same river, the Potomac. Now, I think that sounds surprising for two reasons. First, when we think of the Potomac, we tend to think about American politics, not American history. And second, when we think of Robert E. Lee, we tend to imagine him personifying an old South that seems light years away from the cosmopolitan capital city that Washington has become. But the truth is far different. Reminders of Robert E. Lee are all around where I live. And fortunately for me, one of those reminders was the majority of Robert E. Lee's papers are in driving distance. But writing a biography requires more than just looking at old papers. It also requires getting out and seeing the places where history actually happened. And as I said, Robert E. Lee's history took place all around where I live. During the course of my work on this book, my wife and I say my wife because I dragged her along, drove the full distance of the Potomac River from its source in West Virginia, where it starts as a little trickle, yes, we actually did see that, to Point Lookout, Maryland, where it empties into the Chesapeake Bay. We literally drove that full distance. So for those of you wondering, of all the things I needed to write this biography, by far and away, the most important was an understanding spouse. But if you ever make the trip that we made along the Potomac, you learn some things. You learn that the Potomac is much more than the polluted stream of political corruption that we so often imagine. It's a beautiful river. You learn that Robert E. Lee's history flows up this river. And you learn that in the most unexpected ways, Robert E. Lee's history intersects with the father of our country's history, George Washington's history. If you start way downriver in Westmoreland County, near the Chesapeake Bay, where Robert E. Lee was born on a great plantation called Stratford Hall. And not far from Stratford Hall, you'll find George Washington's birthplace. Now, by the time Robert E. Lee was born in 1807, George Washington was long dead. But the Lee and Washington names had already been fused together. And that was primarily because of Robert E. Lee's father, a man named Henry Lighthorse Harry Lee. Harry Lee had served as a cavalry commander for George Washington during the Revolution. That's where he earned that nickname, Lighthorse. But what he's most famous for is what he did after the Revolution, what he did when George Washington died. It was Harry Lee who delivered George Washington's most famous eulogy. It was Harry Lee who coined those famous words, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. Those are still the words that we most remember George Washington by today. And during Robert E. Lee's childhood, everybody knew that his father had written those words. And to see where Robert E. Lee spent most of his childhood, you have to head just a little bit further up the Potomac River to the town of Alexandria. As the town closest to George Washington's Mount Vernon plantation, Alexandria very much considered itself to be George Washington's hometown. Young Robert, growing up, didn't have to look far to see reminders of George Washington. He could see them at the school he attended, because George Washington had endowed that school. He could see them at the church he attended, because George Washington had owned a pew in that church. And he could see them in the marketplace, where he ran errands for his mother, who was always sick, because George Washington had drilled troops there during the French and Indian War. But to see what most connects Robert E. Lee to George Washington's legacy, you have to head just a little bit further up the Potomac, to that column mansion that sits across the Potomac from where the Lincoln Memorial now stands, Arlington House. There, on June 30th, 1831, Robert E. Lee married the daughter of George Washington's adopted son. Now, today we know Arlington as our national cemetery, but it was originally built by George Washington's adopted son, a man named George Washington Parke Custis, as a memorial to George Washington. If you had visited the house in the decades before the Civil War, you would have seen all kinds of different reminders of George Washington. You would have seen china and furniture that had adorned Mount Vernon. You would have seen the bed where George Washington had died. And you would have seen a sadder legacy of Mount Vernon, slaves who had descended from the old house. Now, you might ask yourself, how is that possible? Didn't George Washington emancipate all of his slaves when he died? He did, but much as he wanted to, he couldn't emancipate his wife's slaves. And some of those slaves became the property of Robert E. Lee's father-in-law. And when Robert E. Lee's father-in-law died in 1857, he left a will naming Robert E. Lee as executor of his estate. And so on the eve of the Civil War in the late 1850s, Robert E. Lee is living in Arlington House and managing slaves who George Washington had wanted to but could not free. And so it was that the unresolved question of slavery was very much one of the personal legacies that Robert E. Lee inherited from George Washington. And to see how the unresolved question of slavery led to violence, you have to head just 60 miles upriver from Arlington to the quaint town of Harper's Ferry. In 1859, a group of abolitionists led by one John Brown crossed the Potomac River, seized a federal armory in Harper's Ferry, and took a group of hostages, including a great-grandnephew of George Washington, a man named Lewis Washington. And John Brown took something else from Lewis Washington. He took a sword that had belonged to George Washington. And for most of the time that he holds Harper's Ferry, he holds this sword in his hand. So who does the federal government call out to reassert federal control at Harper's Ferry? Lieutenant Colonel Robert E. Lee. And Robert E. Lee puts down the rebellion and adds another laurel to his already sparkling resume. But what becomes known as John Brown's raid does something far more important. It heralds the coming of the American Civil War. And that brings me to the very last place I want to mention in this trip up the Potomac River. It's a quiet national park just upriver from Harper's Ferry. There you'll find a cornfield, a sunken road, and a stone bridge over a creek called the Antietam. There on September 17th, 1862, Robert E. Lee and the outmanned and outgunned Army of Northern Virginia fought the larger Army of the Potomac to a draw in the bloodiest day of combat in American history. The Battle of Antietam marked the end of Robert E. Lee's first invasion across the Potomac. But it also did something far more important. It gave Abraham Lincoln the opportunity to issue the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation and to give a new birth of freedom to the Union that George Washington had forged. Now, anyone who takes the trip that I've just described, anyone who traces Robert E. Lee's history up the Potomac, must confront an inevitable and unavoidable question. How did an Army officer so closely associated with George Washington's legacy go to war against George Washington's greatest legacy, the Union? It was that question that ultimately drew me to Robert E. Lee's story. And the knowledge that history could have turned out so much differently had Lee just chosen differently at the start of the war, when leaders on both sides of the Potomac sought his service for high command, when an emissary for Abraham Lincoln called Lee to the city of Washington and said, "The country looks to you as the representative of the Washington family to save the Union that Washington had forged." Herman Melville once wrote, "Who looks at Lee must think of Washington, and pain must think and hide the thought, so deep with grievous meaning it is fraught." Well, I think we've hidden the thought for too long. I'm looking forward to discussing with all of you today, and thanks, and looking forward to our conversation, George.
Thanks, Jonathan. So let's delve a little bit more about the premise of your book. Tell us what's going on.
Sure. And I think it'd be helpful to zero in on this decision that Lee faces in April 1861. I said that he is going to receive offers of command from leaders on both sides of the Potomac, in Washington and in Virginia. And one of those offers is going to come from an emissary for Abraham Lincoln, a man named Francis Blair, who's going to call Robert E. Lee across from Arlington to Washington for a meeting. And so Robert E. Lee is going to ride across the bridge from Arlington and meet with Mr. Blair, who's going to have this incredible offer, which he says, well, you lead the main Union army being raised to crush secession. And Lee's going to tell Blair that he opposed secession. This is an important point. Lee thought that secession was illegal. And equally significantly, he thought that George Washington would have opposed secession. And that was no given at the time, because people on both sides of this conflict in Washington, in the North, people are going to say, look at George Washington's farewell address. It says, prize the Union above any local allegiance. People in the South are going to say, no, George Washington rebelled against a union with the British. And as Robert E. Lee is hearing these arguments, he's going to actually sit down and read a biography of George Washington, and he's going to come to the conclusion that Washington thought that secession was illegal, and he would have never allowed for it. But Lee is also going to decide that he can't raise his sword against his native state of Virginia. And so he's going to turn down that command, even though he knows that he's casting himself on the side of the war that he thinks does not represent Washington's legacy. And so that's what drew me to this book as I was talking about it. And that's the premise that I wanted to get to, because I think the decision that Robert E. Lee made to go to war against Washington's greatest legacy is going to tear his bonds to George Washington's legacy in these really astonishingly personal ways.
So talk to us a little bit about Lee's character, because this obviously was the impetus that drove him to that decision.
Right. And I think that's a great question. And to get a sense of Lee's character, you have to go back to his childhood. I mentioned his father was Harry Lee, who was served with George Washington during the Revolutionary War. What I didn't tell you was that he was also a compulsive gambler. And he bet all of his money on land, and he lost really badly. He ends up in debtor's prison. And during the War of 1812, Harry Lee sails off into exile in the Caribbean. Young Robert never saw his father ever again. So in some sense, that's why Robert E. Lee is going to spend most of his childhood not on a great plantation in Westmoreland County, but why he's going to spend it in Alexandria. And because of his legacy that hangs over him, of his father's being compulsive and sort of following his own desires too far, Robert E. Lee's mother, who's always sick, is going to teach her son the economy that his father lacked. She is going to teach her son to put duty before desire. And for the rest of Robert E. Lee's life, in some way, he's going to talk as if he's playing a role in a script beyond his control. He's going to say he can never have things his own way. And so I think if you take that, and that's consistent throughout his life, his feeling that he can't control events and he has no choices, and you look at the decision he made when he went to war against the Union that he knew represented Washington's greatest legacy, or at least he knew in 1861, after the war, he's going to change his views conveniently. He's going to basically just say, I didn't have a choice. He's going to say, I couldn't have my own way, so I had to have Virginia's way. And yet, we know that other Virginians did go a different way. Robert E. Lee's mentor in the military was a man named Winfield Scott. And he was also a Virginian. He was the commanding general in the Union Army. And he stayed loyal to the Union. And when he heard that Robert E. Lee had turned down that Union command, he said, Lee, you have made the greatest mistake of your life, but I feared it would be so.
So when you think about his character, decisions are out of his control. What tied him to Virginia? Was it the historical Washington? What was it that cemented his relationship with the state of Virginia?
And that's, again, a great question. And Robert E. Lee himself, and again, we don't totally have to guess about these things because Robert E. Lee has correspondence, and we have so many of his letters as the Union is coming apart, and he's watching these events with his reactions to what is happening. And he's fairly consistent. He says he's always learned from his earliest recollections that he was taught that his first loyalty is to Virginia. And that does surprise a lot of people even back then, because they say, how can someone whose father, who was George Washington's greatest eulogist and who had married the daughter of George Washington's adopted son, come to that conclusion when the farewell address that Washington left us says to prize the Union above any local allegiance? So that question that you're asking now was asked in 1861, and we can really only go back to Robert E. Lee's own writings, where he says he was taught from the very beginning that his first allegiance was due to Virginia. Now, I do think there are some other factors that could go into this as well, and one of them being he had some experience, for the most part during his life, he had tried to avoid slavery. It wasn't that he was an abolitionist. He just simply didn't want to be involved with the institution. But it was his father-in-law's will that most involves him in that institution. And we can get into this more later, but the experiences he has as a slaveholder are going to, I think, in some way tilt his sympathies to the South.
And when you think about this decision, he paid a severe price, if you will. Talk a little bit about what the impact on his life, that decision, how it impacted his life. He died, I think, in 1876 or
1870.
70. Okay. So only 4 years after the, 5 years after the end of the Civil War.
Right, right. And in some cases, we forget that he even lived those 5 years because we sort of think it's just, you hear about Appomattox and you assume that Robert E. Lee's life just disappears from history. But of course, he didn't disappear from history. He had a very active career after the Civil War, which we can talk about too. But going back to the question about the price he paid for the decision, I think there's no greater symbol for the price that Robert E. Lee paid for the decision than if you go to Arlington. I mentioned that's where Robert E. Lee was living on the eve of the Civil War. It was never his house. It's important to make that point. It was his wife's house. And of course, now anyone who goes to Arlington knows it's a cemetery. Well, what happened is when Robert E. Lee made his decision to turn down the Union command, 3 days later, he's going to resign his commission in the Union Army after what his wife will describe as the severest struggle of his life. And he's going to head to Richmond, and he's going to accept command of all of Virginia's armed forces. And he knows in doing that, that he has forever given up Arlington. And the reason he knows that is if you've ever stood in Washington and you look up at the Arlington Heights, you can realize that whoever commands the Arlington Heights commands the city of Washington. And Union authorities were more than aware that if Confederates or Virginians had managed to put cannons up on the Arlington Heights, they could have bombarded the White House. So the very first thing that Union soldiers are going to do when they cross the Potomac River to start the Civil War is they are going to go up the Arlington Heights and they are going to seize Arlington. And in time, as casualties mount and more men die, Union authorities are going to make the decision to convert the Arlington estate where Robert E. Lee married the daughter of George Washington's adopted son into the cemetery we know today. And that's just one example of the price Lee paid. I think actually as you read more, as you get into this more, you'll be astonished because another thing that happens is one of the very first places commands he has is in Western Virginia. And who does he bring as his aide? The last heir to Mount Vernon, a member of the Washington family, who's going to die under his command. And so in this really oddly symbolic way, the decision that Robert E. Lee makes to fight against the Union is going to shred his bonds. All the things that connected him to that Union are going to be destroyed by the choice he makes.
Yeah, but it's very interesting because after the war, he worked so hard for reconciliation within the between the North and the South, goes off to what was then Washington College, becomes the president. Tell us a little bit about what life was like for Lee after Appomattox.
I'm so glad you asked that question because, as I said, so often those last 5 years of Robert E. Lee's life get lost. So Robert E. Lee didn't really know what was going to happen to him after Appomattox. I mean, any number of things could have happened to somebody who went to war against the Union. But at first he thinks maybe he'll just settle for being a farmer. Who knows if he can even own land. But then an offer comes from this college in the Shenandoah Valley. And they offer him the presidency of this institution called Washington College. And as it turns out, Washington College has a very real connection to George Washington. George Washington had endowed the institution very early in its history. And a lot of people think that Robert E. Lee is not going to accept this offer, that the college is not important enough for him. If he wanted to be the president of a college, he could be the president of a bigger southern university. But Robert E. Lee thinks this is actually a great opportunity because for 4 years he's led the young men of the South in war, and now he has the opportunity, as he sees it, to prepare them for peace. So he's going to accept that offer, and he's actually going to be a very involved college president, but he really is going to actually work toward expanding that institution into a university. And today, as you mentioned, that institution is Washington and Lee University, and it's one of the better institutions in America.
Talk to us a little bit about some of the sources that you used in your book, and what were some of the more illuminating sources?
Well, by far the most important source I had was Lee's family papers. And one of the things that happens when you lose a war, you don't end up with a library dedicated to your name. So your papers get scattered in many different institutions. But that actually turned out to be quite a deal of fun because you get to drive around to different archives and see what their collections are. And so there's just no way around, I think, if you want to write a biography of someone to get their correspondence. And what makes Robert E. Lee's correspondence so valuable is the amount of time that he spent away from his family. Now, why is that so important? Because someone who's spending time away from their family is going to write lots of letters describing what is happening to them. If you live with your family, you're not going to say, today I did this and tomorrow I plan to do that. But Robert E. Lee does write those things. He also writes his emotions. He responds to what's happening to his family's life. And the reason he's spending so much time away from his family is he is an officer at first in the U.S. Army and, of course, later in the Confederate Army. And his wife was often not well. She was in a wheelchair for much of later years of her life, and she couldn't follow him. So this is a very valuable tool for a biographer to have this correspondence, and there's really no way around saying that that was by far the most important source I had.
So here we have, and I hesitate to use the word traitor, but here we have this traitor who deserted the country and led the Confederate Army. How has history treated him?
I think that's a great question. And history has treated him different ways at different moments. In 1870, when Robert E. Lee dies, there's, of course, an outpouring of emotion from people in the South. And there are numerous eulogies given to Robert E. Lee. And, of course, how is everybody in the South going to eulogize Robert E. Lee when he dies? Well, the exact same way that Robert E. Lee's father eulogized George Washington as first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. And even the New York Times will run an obituary saying, you know, we think Robert E. Lee made a terrible decision at the start of the war, but we applaud the course that he has taken after the war. And a Kentucky senator is hearing these things, and he gets the idea and says, you know, I think there's a lot of goodwill toward Robert E. Lee in the country, and I think now is a good time to stand up in the Senate and propose, let's give Arlington back to Robert E. Lee's family, and let's even consider the idea of taking those bodies who have been buried in the ground and moving them somewhere else. And one after another, senators in the Senate stand up and denounce Robert E. Lee as a traitor. And that idea does not go too far. There's a separate story that we can get into about what happened, because the fight for Arlington was not over with that. But it gives you a feel that there were a lot of really angry people at Robert E. Lee in 1870. It was not like people just forgot about what happened during the war. 600,000 people had died, after all. But sometime in the early 20th century, there became sort of this feeling that you both sides could honor soldiers on both sides. And Robert E. Lee's reputation went up, and people started talking about what a great general he was. And actually, if you looked at what happened, Ulysses S. Grant's reputation would go down as Robert E. Lee's reputation went up, because the thought was the only way Ulysses S. Grant could beat Robert E. Lee was that he was a butcherer of men, and he just beat Robert E. Lee with throwing soldiers at Robert E. Lee's army. And I think now, right now, if you look at things, things have changed again. I think Ulysses S. Grant stands in pretty good standing in the United States, and I think attitudes toward Robert E. Lee, as we've seen in recent months, are at best mixed, and depending where you live. So I think he's a very polarizing figure right now. What was great for me to be able to write this book is so often we try to make historical figures stand for something. It was great just to be able to see him as a man, which of course is what you do when you read somebody's letters. You realize that they're just a person.
So talk to us a little bit about Lee's view on slavery, and also see if you can tie in what's going on today. You think about the Black Matter movement and talk of taking down some of the Civil War statues on the boulevard in Richmond. Connect the two.
Sure. So Robert E. Lee's stance on slavery. He said that slavery was an evil institution, and that's a famous line. But two sentences later, and this is probably going to shock you, he said he thought it was worse for whites than for the slaves themselves. He prayed for a day that God would end slavery, but he certainly was no abolitionist. What he most wanted, essentially, was to have as little to do with slavery as possible. But as I mentioned, what most entangles him in this institution is his marriage to the daughter of George Washington's adopted son. What's fascinating as you look at attitudes toward Robert E. Lee today, and of course we've had this debate in this country about what should happen to monuments to the Confederacy, and if you've ever driven through the South, every southern town has monuments to the Confederacy, and there are many statues of Robert E. Lee all over the place. What's so interesting is that one person who certainly wasn't in favor of building any statues to the Confederacy was Robert E. Lee. And we don't actually have to guess about this because, again, he put this all in his letters after the war. He gets a letter from Gettysburg where they propose putting markers of stone where the armies were. And Robert E. Lee says, no, I think we should just basically bulldoze the battlefield and get rid of it. And, of course, that might be understandable for someone who ordered Pickett's Charge. They didn't want to preserve Gettysburg. But he thought that the best way to move on from a civil war was to simply destroy all reminders of the Civil War. And he's actually very consistent about this. At one time, he gets asked to raise money for a monument to Stonewall Jackson, who, of course, was Robert E. Lee's most famous lieutenant who had died under Robert E. Lee's command. And Robert E. Lee says, nah, I think it's kind of a waste of money, and I think it could produce some agitation in the country, and the best thing we can do is not put up a statue of Stonewall Jackson and just all move on. And we have other examples of this. These were not isolated things. He believed that it was best to get rid of symbols. So I think I'm always cautious because you can't put a historical figure on the record today because things are so much different. And it's not fair to, for example, ask what would Robert E. Lee think about, you know, Obamacare, because he couldn't imagine Obamacare. So I don't want to go too far with this answer, but I think it's probably not too much to think that he would come down on the side of saying, let's remove these reminders. Now, I think that should also give us a bit of caution in terms of, and I think we can draw a distinction between the Confederate flag, which really has a separate meaning at this point of just hatred and racism and has a contemporary political meaning. But if you tear down every statue, you sort of are doing Robert E. Lee's bidding, which is he just wanted to move on and pretend like this never happened. And I think it is important to keep some reminders, and even if it's painful reminders, and it's reminders that there was a time when we memorialized people who today we don't think we should memorialize anymore, it's important to remember that our forebears put those statues up and we disagree with those decisions. So sometimes the best solution to a statue we don't like is to put up a statue to someone we do like, or we feel we want to memorialize today and leave our own records instead of just doing what Robert E. Lee did, which is sometimes the easier way out, which is just wiping out reminders of something that happened.
Let's go back to Lee's character for a second, because I was intrigued by your comment that Lee couldn't control decisions. How do you match that up against his military genius, where he obviously had complete control of those decisions? What was it in his personality and character that allowed him to delegate more, as an example, than was traditionally the response?
And that's a fantastic question, because our impression of Robert E. Lee, of course, is of this daring general who's constantly having these incompetent Union generals on their heels, and he's outnumbered, and he's constantly somehow going on the offensive, even though he should be on the defensive. And how do we square that with somebody who says, I can never have my own way, even though seemingly on the battlefield, he's always having his own way? Well, the answer is, on the battlefield, too, if you look at how he explains why he's doing these things, he again feels that he has no choice. And the reason he feels he has no choice is he feels that the odds against him are so desperate that he has no choice but to take these risks. And so I think that's one of the great ironies of Robert E. Lee's generalship, is that a man who thought he had no control over events is constantly taking control of events because he feels he has no choice. So that's fairly confusing, I think. But it's true, and it's the way he saw it, that the odds were just so far against him that he had to take all kinds of risks, and he has no choice but to seize the initiative, because if he doesn't seize the initiative, he's going to let the Union Army just inch toward Richmond and make the war a siege and just make it about who has more soldiers to put into the battle, and he thinks he'll lose that war.
Freud would have a wonderful time with Lee if he could.
People have tried looking at him through that angle.
So I have other questions, but what I think I would like to do is I'd like it to open it up to the audience for questions. There are two mics in the back, and you'll assist with the mics. So question from that gentleman, but I think you need to stand up at the microphone so everybody can hear the question. Thank you.
Yes, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on General Lee's taking the Confederate generalship. I can understand that he didn't want to raise his sword against his state, but he ended up raising his sword against his former colleagues. He was, after all, a West Point graduate.
And that's an outstanding question, and I'm glad you worded it like that, because there really are separate decisions. We tend to just sort of make it all one decision, but there are separate decisions. And Robert E. Lee himself acknowledges that when he writes the letter on April 20th, 1861, resigning his commission in the U.S. Army after what his wife would call the severest struggle of his life. He says, he writes a letter where he says, you know, maybe now I can just stay home in Arlington and sit this war out. And yet 3 days later, just 3 days after that very severe struggle, he's going to show up in Richmond and accept command of all of Virginia's armed forces. And he's going to square that by saying, essentially, that he's been called to defend Virginia, and he can only raise his sword. He can't raise his sword against Virginia, and his condition is he'll only raise his sword in defense of Virginia. And so, again, we're sort of stuck with what Lee tells us. And he is fairly consistent about this. So in some sense, the same forces that drove him to go against his understanding of what the Union was in 1861, and again, Lee has a different conception of the Union in 1865, in 1861, and it's all going to lead, that same logic is going to land him in Richmond, accepting command of all Virginia's armed forces. But that's a great question. I'm glad you worded it like that.
It's a naive question, but in any of his letters or writings, particularly before the sort of end times of the war, when you know sort of he knew that defeat was pretty much inevitable, what did he imagine the best outcome would be for the secessionist cause?
And that's a great question too. I think Lee essentially becomes obsessed with destroying the Union Army. And the reason he becomes obsessed with destroying the Union Army is he thinks that is the only way he can win the war. And now today, I think there's a revisionist stance that's more, why didn't Lee just kind of hang back, stay on the defensive, conserve his strength, and avoid major battles, and perhaps even fight a guerrilla warfare rather than committing his troops to battle as he so often did? But then again, you have to remember why the South, why the Civil War had taken place. The Civil War, the South was fighting the Civil War in defense, and again, this is just a fact. They were fighting to defend slavery. And as the war is going to go on, and Lincoln is going to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, Robert E. Lee is going to realize that as Union soldiers move through the South, they are going to be destroying the South's social order. And Lee basically thinks he has to snap the North's political will to fight before the South's social order is shredded. And I think events, to some degree, will bear this out, that time is not necessarily on his side. And it's sort of a more revisionist idea that it was on his side. And so that is what he's thinking. That is what he's thinking at Gettysburg. He does not think time is on his side. He thinks it is not on his side, and he needs to end this conflict. And he certainly wants Lincoln to lose that election. And when, of course, Lincoln is reelected, Lee thinks this is a very severe blow, and he writes his wife, "I guess we have to make up our minds for 4 more years of war if, of course, the Confederacy can hold out for 4 more months. And so, again, I think that gives you an idea of how he saw things.
Lee may have his famous letter saying he disapproved of slavery was in 1852, yet of his own choice, he actively bought slaves in 1856. So I wonder how you can reconcile that with him saying he has no choice, yet he actively, of his own volition, buys slaves in 1856, after that famous letter.
Well, I'm not exactly sure what purchase you're referring to in 1856, but we do. He does when he's in Texas, he will say at some point that he's thinking about buying a slave because he can't find a white man to be his servant, and he'd prefer to employ a white man, but he's thinking about hiring a slave at that point. Again, I think that letter, the famous quote from Lee, where he says he thinks slavery is evil, but he thinks it's worse for whites than blacks, does not imply that Lee is somehow saying that slavery, he's come out as an abolitionist. In fact, if you go on that quote a little further, he says that slavery is necessary, and he says he doesn't know how long it'll be necessary. And again, these words are hard for us to hear today because they're so repugnant to everything we believe, but this is what he wrote. And he doesn't know how long slavery will be necessary for the education of the African-American race. Now, that attitude, of course, is awful, and it is hard for us to hear those words, but that is what Lee thought. And to think that Robert E. Lee was an abolitionist, as some, you know, or was opposed to slavery, is a mistake. He was not opposed to slavery. He thought it was evil. He wished it didn't exist, but he accepted the fact that it did exist. And, in fact, in 1857, when he takes control of his father-in-law's estate, his father-in-law has left a will calling for all of his slaves to be emancipated within 5 years' time. And it has a competing clause which says, we also must pay a series of debts and legacies, and you must raise a lot of money. And there was no way to raise that money except to work slaves, because his father-in-law's plantations were completely dependent on slave labor. So Robert E. Lee actually goes to court to ask a judge to extend, and this is important, to extend the service of his father-in-law's slaves beyond the 5-year period. And some of you have heard the famous story that Robert E. Lee emancipated the Custis slaves right at the time of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. But what you may not know is he's only doing that because a Virginia court has ruled that he can't keep them in service any longer. So some of the facts of this have been slightly distorted, and we shouldn't go too far in saying how far and how opposed Robert E. Lee was to slavery. It's possible for him to say that slavery was evil, but to come up to the conclusion that it was a necessary evil, and that's really where he was, and we can't change that about him.
So I want to ask another question about Lee's character. As what you had just said, now I'm somewhat confused, because he has a will a wheelchair-bound wife. He has been given the estate, his wife's estate, and yet he deserts her to take on command of the Southern Army. When is the house actually taken by the Union? And how did she feel about this? Because now she's got to leave her family heritage, which he's really, she has to give up her family estate. He has divided his loyalty to the Washington heritage and goes off to fight the war. So I'm wondering, first of all, what was their relationship after the war? Where did she go when she had to, the family go when they had to leave Arlington? And what happens to the slaves after he has just fought for their, not to give them their freedom? I mean, they're probably, what happens?
Well, those are three outstanding questions. And I'm glad you asked about his wife. Because when we think about the price Robert E. Lee paid, so much of the price was the price his wife paid. And we know that when Robert E. Lee wrote his letter resigning from the U.S. Army, he called his family down to read them the letter. And he said, "I know that you all think that I have done wrong," which gives you an indication that his family wasn't necessarily on board with this decision. And in fact, we know Mary wrote, his wife's name was Mary, Mary Lee wrote that the Union had long been her boast and joy. And so I think this really was shocking for her to some extent. Now, so what's going to happen is Robert E. Lee is going to head to Richmond on a couple days after making that, resigning from the Union Army. And his wife is going to stay at Arlington because she doesn't want to leave. And he's going to start writing some letters and sort of saying, I think you should pack up all the Mount Vernon relics and leave because it would be embarrassing if you fall behind Union lines. At first, it's rather calm, and, he gets a response back from his wife. She's doing her normal thing in Arlington. And then, he'll write again a few days later and say, I really think you should leave Arlington. And again, she doesn't leave Arlington. And then he gets more and more panicked. You really, really need to leave Arlington very quickly. And so she really cuts it pretty close in terms of leaving Arlington. And she even says that she would rather stay and see what Union soldiers would do to the great-granddaughter of, or to the daughter of George Washington's adopted son. And so eventually she will leave Arlington, but it will be in a real mess. She'll try to pack up as many of the Mount Vernon relics as she can. She'll ship some to Shenandoah Valley. She'll send some to her friend's house. She'll leave some behind. And Union newspapers will make a great deal of the fact that she's left behind so much of her inheritance at Arlington. They'll say this shows that she doesn't appreciate her connections to George Washington. And those will be put in the patent office in Washington, essentially as captured relics from Arlington. And so I think in some sense, Mary Lee has gotten a bad rap in history because so much of her writing that we have is after the war where she's very bitter. She's bitter about what Union soldiers have done to her inheritance. She's a very bitter woman, and she actually does go back to Arlington after her husband. Robert E. Lee himself never goes back to Arlington. He says, "I know very well how things are there," and he doesn't care to see it. But she does, and she goes for a short visit and then says she never cares to see the place again, and within a couple months, and she's dead. So she really is heartbroken about what happens to Arlington. So that's a great question.
She doesn't blame.
No, she in some sense she says whatever I thought about the start of this war, it's now our duty to resist. She basically decides it's her duty to follow her husband. And as the war goes on, she gets more and more outraged by what she thinks the Union soldiers are doing to her inheritance. And we mentioned what happened to Arlington, but the Custis family loses another house, which is called the White House and the Pamunkey, which is near Richmond, which is where George Washington had wooed Martha Washington. And that house is going to be destroyed during the Civil War, too. And so actually, if you go through and look at all the different connections that this family has to Washington, they really are all going to be destroyed by Robert E. Lee's decision to go to war against the Union. So it's a great question.
Yes.
So in connection again with this connection with Washington, and since you've read his letters, I wonder if you can speak. It seems to me that in a way, Lee was fighting a fight not unlike Washington's, if you look at it a certain way. I mean, here's this overpowering force that's against his forces, and his point here is just to win enough battles to make it really, really expensive so they'll make a negotiated settlement. Does that sound like, does he ever say anything like that?
Well, in the sense that you're saying that in some sense, did the Confederacy ever see itself?
Or did he see himself kind of as another Washington?
Well, certainly by the Confederacy saw him that way at some point. It's worth pointing out, by the way, that we tend to have this image that Robert E. Lee took the field for the Confederacy and was immediately successful compared to all these bungling Union generals. And that isn't quite what happened. Robert E. Lee took the field at first, and he was a disaster. His first commands were in Western Virginia, and I call it Western Virginia instead of West Virginia, because Robert E. Lee's job would be to defend Western Virginia, and he would do a very bad job. His battle plans were confusing, and they always involved independent columns converging at one moment exactly at precise times. These things never happened. And when he comes back after that campaign, Southern newspapers are going to say Robert E. Lee is too much of an engineer. And by the way, that is Robert E. Lee's training as an engineer from West Point. And not enough of a fighter. It's not going to be until 1862 when Robert E. Lee repulses General McClellan during the Peninsula Campaign that Southern newspapers are going to begin saying Robert E. Lee is the greatest general in history. He is the second coming of George Washington, and those comparisons will start being made. Robert E. Lee himself didn't compare himself to George Washington. He did occasionally say to his soldiers, you are trotting the same path that your ancestors fought on the road to revolution, on the road to independence. He did make that comparison for his soldiers. But the closest that Robert E. Lee himself ever came to equating himself with George Washington wasn't before the war, it wasn't during the war, it was after the war, when he was urging former fellow Confederates to accept the outcome, when he was saying that he hoped that his fellow former Confederates would help put the country back together. And the way he justified that was he said that at one time George Washington had fought with the British against the French during the French and Indian War, and at another time he had fought against the British during the American Revolution. And basically what explains his actions was that circumstances dictate patriotism, and that something that could be wrong in one time could be right at another time. And that's how Robert E. Lee explained his own transition from leader of the rebellion to leader for reconciliation, and that was how he explained his own transformation from unionist to secessionist to unionist again.
And that would also fit in with, I mean, Washington's idea of being like Cincinnatus, right? I will now go back to my farm and be a peaceful person.
Right. Now, of course, Robert E. Lee didn't have a farm to go back to. But he played around with the idea for a little bit, saying maybe he would try his luck as a farmer, but then he does get this offer from Washington College.
After the end of the war, was there any thought given to trying Lee for treason, and if not, why not? And were others tried and or hung for treason after the war?
Well, and that's a great question. There was thought to try him for treason. He would be indicted. But it's not going to go forward. And the reason it's not going to go forward is because of Ulysses S. Grant. Ulysses S. Grant says he gave Robert E. Lee his word at Appomattox that if he returned home and he obeyed the laws in force where he was, that federal authorities would not bother him further. And so when Robert E. Lee hears that he is going to be indicted for treason, he writes a letter to Grant and saying, it's not my understanding of the terms at Appomattox that this could happen to me. And Grant basically goes so far as to say that he'll resign from the Union Army if this prosecution goes forward. And that's the end of it, because one thing you didn't want to do in 1865 was cross Ulysses S. Grant if you were a Union authority. If Grant said he was going to resign, if you did something, then you didn't do it, because that would have been very bad publicity for you. So that pretty much puts the end of the idea of prosecuting Robert E. Lee.
Was there any evidence in Robert E. Lee's writings of being influenced by arguments that were occurring in Europe or Russia about the end of feudalism? Like the issue of slavery is really could be seen in American history as just one part of a transition from a feudal time to, especially in the South, to a contemporary time. And the slavery issue on the continent and in Russia didn't have the color issue that we inherit as a cultural, as part of our everyday culture.
And that's a great question. I know some people did make those comparisons. I know I was just recently, where John Quincy Adams was talking about some of those comparisons. I can't think of anything off the top of my head where Robert E. Lee makes that point. One thing to say is he, unlike George Washington in some sense, Robert E. Lee was not much of a politician, and he doesn't necessarily have a great grasp of some of these issues. In fact, in one of his more famous letters explaining why he opposes secession, he misquotes the U.S. Constitution. So it's not like he was an expert in any of these areas. He was sort of he was following it. He read a lot of newspapers. He was aware of these issues. But really, in the end, he sort of says that he defers to Providence on all these issues. And that allows him to sort of say, slavery isn't my fault. It's always been here. We've inherited this system. And it will go on as long as Providence deems it necessary. And again, those are painful words for us here to hear today, but that was very much his attitude. And to some extent, for a Southerner at that time, it was more enlightened than some who were making the argument that not only was slavery accepted by Providence, but that it was a good thing. Robert E. Lee didn't go that far, but certainly if you look back, that there were a lot of Southerners who thought slavery was good. And it was good for both whites and for the slaves themselves. Robert E. Lee didn't hold that opinion. And so I don't know if we can say that he was enlightened in that aspect, but by comparison, he was enlightened from that horrible point of view that we have there, though his point of view is no more acceptable to us today, of course. That's a great question.
Hello. Could you speak to how Lee would reacted to battles that he won but didn't seem to gain him anything strategically with the loss of life of his army?
And that's a fantastic question, because there's no greater, more signal victory that we think of with Robert E. Lee in the Battle of Chancellorsville in 1863. He's going to divide his army multiple times. He's basically going to break every single rule of war, and he's going to defeat General Hooker at the Battle of Chancellorsville. And, we have these people writing these scenes that Robert E. Lee rides into the field triumphant, and, it's sort of the highest point in his career. Well, one person who wasn't happy with the results at Chancellorsville was Robert E. Lee. He was furious, and he was furious because the Union Army had escaped, and he had planned one last attack where he was planning to annihilate the Union Army. And actually, if you look at that final position, the Union Army actually had a very strong ground. And so there's some thought that if the Union Army hadn't withdrawn from Chancellorsville, they might have defeated Robert E. Lee, and it could have been Pickett's Charge a few months earlier. So he was not happy. And even at the Battle of Fredericksburg, again, where Union soldiers come in lines and get mowed down, Robert E. Lee is going to say, a lot of Yankees died, but not enough Yankees to suit me, because he wants to destroy the Union Army.
So I think we have time for these two last questions.
Okay. I'm just trying to put all the pieces together. I'm looking at Lee's value system. I'm looking how he looked at slavery, how he looked at secession. And I'm just trying to figure out, what really drove him to want to stand up for the Confederacy, to want to put on that role as general. It seems like his values are a little bit mixed, and maybe his motivation is not really there. So that's why I'm trying to figure out, why did he want to stand up for the Confederacy, and why did he want to lead the charge?
And that's a great question. And I think in some sense, again, it comes down to the fact that he was a man with, you know, different impulses, different emotions at different times. But if you look, he initially said he wasn't very happy to be doing this, that he said it was his duty, but in the early stages of the war, he's saying that the people who have clamored the most for secession are the people least willing to fight. And he didn't encourage this, and yet he's the responsibility for secession is falling on him and the people who clamored for it the most. And he says he's very unimpressed with the spirit of the South. And he finds that especially when he goes, he serves a short service in the deeper South, in South Carolina and Georgia, and he finds that the attitudes there he finds very displeasing. And even at the end of the war, as things are really falling apart, and it's becoming clearer that he's going to lose, we have stories of him saying things like, you know, I told Southerners that there was no chance they would win this war unless every man did his duty, and every man has not done his duty, and I warned them. There were a lot of people in the South who simply thought Yankees couldn't fight and this war would be over really quickly, and Robert E. Lee was never one of them. In the very beginning, he said this war could take 10 years if you want to accomplish. He had seen the country. That's one thing that his service in the U.S. Army had taught him. He had traveled a lot. He had met a lot of different people, and he knew the Yankees would fight for the Union. So that gives you some sense of that.
Just a brief question. I had read that after the war had ended that Lee sent a letter to the State Department, I believe, asking that his citizenship be reinstated. He did not hear back from them, and he assumed that his request had been rejected. I guess it had turned out that the letter had been lost. It hadn't been found for a number of years, and then 100 years later, Congress votes to reinstate his citizenship. So I'm just wondering, was that act on Lee's part, was it just an attempt at reconciliation, or was he really a Unionist at heart?
So actually, and that's a great question. What gets lost is he does send a letter. It's not a letter. It's basically a loyalty oath. And he actually takes this loyalty oath. It's to support, protect, and defend the U.S. Constitution. The same day that he takes office as president of Washington College. And it is going to, in fact, get lost and show up much later. Someone's going to make this discovery in the archives. And I think in terms of Lee himself, it gives an indication more of that he did encourage other Southerners to take this step. Because it wasn't necessarily that he was saying, you know, rah, rah, I'm so happy about the outcome of the war. It was more saying that this issue has been decided by terms of arms. And since it has gone to war, it has been decided in favor of the Union, and now it is every man's duty to accept the outcome, and I am going to set this example by taking a loyalty oath. And that's what he did.
So, Jonathan Horn, author of The Man Who Would Not Be Washington, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
All of you for
thank you so much.
Participating.